Welcome to The Word at Westminster, a podcast with talks, studies, interviews, sermons, and more from Westminster Church in Barrie, Canada. It's about learning and living God's Word. Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special episode. And we are here having a conversation with Dr. James Watson, and I'll introduce him in a second. And also, the other interviewee is Alton Ruff, and he will introduce himself as well. But we are co-chairs of the Mission and Revitalization Team of the Presbytery of Barrie. And the background is that James came to our presbytery meeting on May 14th and had a talk on invitational community. And he shared some really great things about that. And what we did as a part of that was we invited people to submit some questions because, you know, when we hear about, you know, new information like this, how do we be hospitable and be an invitational community as churches in this rapidly changed and changing world? Certain ideas, questions percolate and come to mind. And so people were invited from the presbytery to submit questions. And this is really an opportunity that James has agreed to that Alton and I can follow up a little bit with some of these questions that people have submitted. And maybe this is a helpful resource for you as a Christian, wherever you're listening from in general. Maybe you're a leader in a church, you're a deacon, you're a pastor, you're someone else. Or you're just kind of curious, a member of a congregation. And so these are hopefully some good things to think about as we seek to be the hands and feet of Christ in this world. So let me say a few things about James. James is a research fellow at the Canadian Institute for Empirical Church Research at Wycliffe College. He grew up in a small rural church context and now lives in Kitchener. He has 15 years of research experience and was a pastor at a Mennonite church plant. He has done interdenominational consulting and has focused on the areas of church health and at-risk churches. And so that's a little bit about James. He has a wide range of experience. And Alton, I'd like to ask you, before we get into our first questions, could you just say a few things about yourself so people who are listening and who might not know you may be able to, just get a better sense about who you are?
Absolutely, Matthew. I want to thank you for having me on the podcast. And hi to you, James. Glad to have you here as well. I'm a big fan of the UpDevo that has been around for quite a while, Matthew. You do great work with that.
Well,
and so it's an honor to be on the podcast and do this with you. I have been a minister in the Presbyterian Church for coming up on 20 years now. I got a start in the Baptist Church when I was 17, not long after I came to faith in the Baptist Church. So I've attended many different denominations, many different churches, some very welcoming, some not so welcoming. And so this is a topic as a pastor that's near and dear to my heart as we talk about how can we be invitational churches, especially in a modern world that is very fractured, very divided. And sometimes we don't even know how to be welcoming or invitational churches. So I am currently the minister at First Presbyterian Church in Collingwood. I've been there for 3 whole months now, but I'm loving it in that welcoming congregation. At least to me, it's been welcoming. So hopefully we'll learn a little bit more about how we can do better on that today.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Alton and James. Again, thank you so much for taking the time to be here and answer our questions.
Thank you so much for having me in the podcast.
So let's just jump right into it. So people were invited to ask questions. Here's the first one. You said that you visited dozens of congregations as a first-time visitor, and that's like even this year. Can you tell us two things you observed that churches do well to welcome first-timers, and perhaps two things that churches don't tend to do well to welcome first-time visitors?
Sure. My wife and I actually went to two church plants on Sunday of this week. In the Sunday afternoon. And this has, you know, been part of my research program for 2024 to sort of ground the word research and the numerical research we're doing in actual like experience of church plants. And these two church plants that we visited on Sunday afternoon, the first one was about, been going for about almost 10 years, I believe. About 30 people. The second one was about 30 people. The second one was very new. They just started doing monthly worship services once, you know, one Sunday afternoon, evening per month back in January. So other than the age, there was a lot of similarities in terms of demographics and very different traditions, but both ones that Kathy and I were quite familiar with, you know, that we've had years of attending within those traditions. So I would say the contrast was with the first one, you know, the preacher, she was very accessible. She shared personal stories, wonderful worship. But the folks there, you got the sense that some of them knew each other, but they didn't really do much to get to know us as new visitors. And I assume in a group that small, that probably we were very noticeable as new visitors. The preacher's husband, it's a co-pastor situation. He was out in the lobby as people were leaving, and they encouraged people to, you know, sort of chat. And there was some chatting happening in the sanctuary afterwards, but we sort of slipped out in the lobby and did have a good conversation with the one co-pastor. So it's not that the pastoral team were standoffish at all, but you just didn't get that sense of the folks at the congregation being interested in who you were, compared to the one we went just a few hours later. And there, again, it's a very new congregation. They've just started worship in January. And that does have an impact, right, on that part of the congregational life cycle, on how people are reacting and looking at their community and whatnot. But there felt very welcomed right away. People were interested in us, asking about who we were, you know. And there seemed to be that sort of genuine warmth and interest. And so I can't say that there's sort of a magic bullet or a button you can press to have people have that sort of invitational community feel that the three of us have been talking about as we've been working through what to present to Presbytery. But that seems hugely valuable. As I've been visiting congregations, when they don't know who you are, but they actually seem really interested in who you are. And I believe most pastors, most ministers have that, you know, and are people. They tend to reach out. But when that's sort of a whole congregational thing, it makes sort of a dynamic where it's like, oh, these all of these people or a lot of these people are interested in who I am. It certainly does something to make you think about, oh, maybe there could be a place for me here.
Do you think that's something that can be learned in a congregation? If you're just following up on that, like, hey, you know, here's how, you know, go out of your way to express interest and kind of show an interest and be welcoming to it, to a new person. Or do you think that's just part of the DNA?
So I think definitely it's getting learned somehow. I don't know for any one church how easy it would be to tease out how it is that got learned. Mm-hmm. But my question is for us as congregations, is that learned? How much of that is learned through sort of the official teaching, right? So there'll be preaching on love your neighbor. You know, there'll be preaching on what it means to be a community of faith. How much of that gets learned through the modeling, that there's some people who have that ability and that's appreciated within the congregation, that they're warm people who have interest in others. How much of that gets learned through some of the structural or programmatic emphases that are developed within a congregation, like, you know, having greeters or having encouraging some people to kind of be on the lookout for people who look new or lost or like they're trying to get things sorted out and you know, to have sort of a gentle approach to checking in with them and getting to know who they are. I suspect it's really a combination of different things and how we learn that. Like, how do we learn to be friendly? And I wonder if that's maybe one of the things to take into consideration as congregants and leaders of congregations, is in what ways are those, I want to use the word attitudes, like it's a little bit deeper than behavior. It's something more about who we are than just what we do. How are those kinds of things nurtured? How are those things encouraged? How do we celebrate that? Hey, oh, this is great. That I was at a church out in the Maritimes where, you know, observed this. It was an administrator from the church, went out in the parking lot to make sure the person they met that week, you know, knew they had a friend to come and sit with in church. Mm. And it was one of the pastors who actually identified, you know, during their leadership meeting, hey, that was great that you did that, right? And so it was actually a neat story for the pastor. They personally found that encouraging and they shared that within their leadership team meeting of, isn't it great that this is what was happening? That was part of the dynamic of our community of faith this morning. Mm-hmm. I think those invitational community elements sometimes require a little bit of, you know, observation and recognition. And that can be part of, I think, that learning environment. And what does it mean to have a culture of invitation?
Yeah, that's helpful. And that kind of leads into the next point here.
Yeah, I've been in many a congregation that would describe themselves as very warm and welcoming, but they were only really warm and welcoming to each other. And this question is, almost every congregation thinks it's warm and welcoming, but church visitors never come back because they did not feel welcome, or at least the person submitting the question assumes that's the case. What specific things can we do to help our congregations change this narrative?
So I think you've touched on something quite significant, Elton. Like, are we even aware, right? Do we have a perception of being warm, friendly people that other people don't get? Like, there's actually sort of an us them kind of barrier or threshold that someone has to cross over for us to feel comfortable with them. And I think that's very natural, right? As humans, we feel more comfortable about people that we kind of know, and we can anticipate what their responses are. And people who are strangers to us, we don't know exactly how they're going to react or what their opinions are. Or, you know, there is a taking a step into the unknown and greeting the person who we don't know. But I do think that one of the first steps that some congregations can take is that self-awareness piece of how do people experience us, right? And it's not always appropriate as visitors come to to pursue them or harass them with an exit interview as they're leaving. But in certain contexts, you know, it can actually be okay to ask people, say, hey, I'm curious as to what it was like for you to come here this morning. I know that it's a big thing to come and visit a new group or to experience something like this. I'm curious as to what your experience was, right? I don't know how many new visitors would be open to that. And probably it requires someone who's taking a very relational, gentle approach, asking those questions for someone to open up. But I do think that self-awareness piece is very important. One of my most heartbreaking conversations on this was speaking to a longtime pastor in a largely English-speaking congregation, but he was the Spanish-speaking pastor. And he said, yeah, I've invited a lot of people here, but we Hispanic people, we tend to be huggy people. And said, the English people don't hug the Spanish-speaking people, but they do hug each other. Right? And so wow,
that says a lot, yeah.
It was that internal awareness piece, like he as an insider, but one who is welcoming a lot of people, had that insight. But obviously there's some people in the congregation for whom they hadn't become aware. And I'm sure they would not want that to be the environment, right? They would not want that to be the experience of people, but there is that lack of awareness. So how do we have those constructive but sometimes difficult conversations that help us develop that more realistic or more healthy awareness?
Well, one thing that we did in a congregation, a former congregation of mine, is we did sort of a secret worshiper thing, where we sent in, I think, two different couples on two different Sundays, and we sent them with a bit of a clipboard. Did you know where the washrooms were? Were you greeted? How would you rate the friendliness? Could you find the nursery? Things like that. And then we took that evidence back to our leadership, because it sort of removed the personal element of it. And people said, oh, okay, we didn't realize this. And another example is when I broke my ankle a few years ago, I realized just how unwelcoming we were to people in a wheelchair, because there was about a 2.5-inch lip in the doorway. And I had such a hard time getting over that. If I didn't have one good leg to sort of turn around and push me up over it, I would have never gotten even in the building without assistance. So sometimes we just need to step back and think of creative ways to remove those rose-colored glasses that we have, I think, to really judge how welcoming we truly are to outsiders.
That's really helpful. And James, you're encouraging, as Alton did in his context, is we need honesty. We need kind of an honest assessment so people know what's actually what's happening or isn't happening if we're going to change that narrative around that. I went to a church in Nova Scotia at one point, this is several years ago, and I was talking to the pastor after, and he realized I'm a pastor. So all of a sudden, I think he realized at that moment I was someone who would give him honest feedback. Said, "Hey, can I get your email? And so, like, can I ask you some questions?" So, like, later that day, it was like, "Was the gospel clear? Did people seem interested in you? Could you follow the service?" You know, it was really he was like looking for feedback. But I think that was a spirit of honesty in himself. He wanted kind of an honest evaluation. Let's jump on to the next question. What is your view of the use of denominational names when identifying churches in the new reality of the declining trust in institutions within our cultural context?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and it's one that comes up in church planning circles all the time, right? When new churches are deciding what is going to be their new name.
Right.
And I've worked in a couple of denominational offices, and it's of interest there too. Like, what does it mean if they don't include the denominational name up front in terms of the relationship with the network, the family? And so I think it's an important question, but my perspective on people who don't have very much church background is that every church name is going to be somewhat weird to them.
Do you mean right? The denominational name or like the name up front?
Any name that? Of any
okay.
church.
Okay.
Right. Whether you say First Presbyterian or you say Glad Tidings or you say Una or you say Restoration as the name yeah. of your church, all of those are going to be odd to someone who doesn't have a lot of church background. Now, if we're talking about people that have some church background, you know, there's certain names that may have certain resonance or raise certain questions for them, perhaps. But I think there's a deeper issue with regards to name in terms of how does our congregation view its identity? How do we embrace who we are? And what is it we want to share with our community? Right. So the church that has deep roots in their tradition and values that relationship with the denomination. I've seen churches where they keep their full name that they've had for, you know, 100 and some years, and then they do something creative around some of their graphics or whatever. Right. Like, so First Baptist Church becomes FBC because they want to try and, you know, present themselves in the community in a slightly different way, but they want to keep what has been their name, and they value what their name means to them, right? So I think there's options for congregations. And the deeper question is, how do we feel about who we are and how we represent ourselves? And then if you have some positive, good feeling about that, then there's all sorts of creativity and how do we present ourselves to our community, right? About what it is that we value, about what we're offering as a community of faith.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
I think in my experience, a lot of people have no understanding what it means to be Presbyterian or Baptist or Anglican. So number one, they walk by the church, they don't even read the sign. They don't really care. Number two, if they read the sign, they wouldn't know what it means. I was at a community supper a couple months ago, and I was in the parking lot just hanging out with the folks as they waited in line to go in for this community supper. And the guy said, "So what's a Presbyterian?" And he had just told me he'd been going to this thing for years. So he'd been in our building for years. No idea what a Presbyterian was. And I honestly didn't really know how to explain that, because I didn't know what his frame of reference was. And I think his frame of reference was pretty much zero. So I had to get to know him to understand where he was coming from before I could even begin to approach that answer.
One of the lessons that I've been learning from church planters that I found really, really helpful is that it's valuable to see the name as raising questions rather than assuming that the name explains things to people.
Mm.
Right? So when someone asks the question, well, what does Presbyterian mean? That's a wide open door for someone who has an appreciation for that tradition. you can say, well, this is what it means for me, right? And so I think there's actually an invitational opportunity when someone doesn't understand the name, but it intrigues them enough that they ask the question.
Yeah, I like that. And maybe I should have said something like, well, it means we love Jesus, and Jesus helps us love others. And that's why you're here at this community dinner that about 20 people are working so hard all day to put on for you, you know, or something like that.
Yeah. I get, I find sometimes that the Presbyterian sounds like pedestrian. So it's like, there's always that confusion. Like, well, you know, we all pedestrians, you know, we all can
we're
be pedestrians,
all
but not all
pedestrians.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, there you go. There you go.
I think that's a sermon series in the making, Presbyterian pedestrians. Walking the life of together, journey with Christ. All right, let's talk about the dramatic increase. This is a long question, so brace yourself. The dramatic increase in people self-identifying as nuns, or SBNR, that is spiritual but not religious, in the past 10 years has reduced the number of church attendees and church visitors / shoppers. Many visitors show up as unhappy or anxious church attendees shopping for a different church. They might be looking for code words such as Orthodox, progressive, traditional, accepting, conservative, inclusive, diverse, Bible-believing, non-traditional, etc. And so the question, the real subtext behind this question is, should we recommend the use of code words as an attempt to achieve honesty in advertising? Can we put people more at ease by more clearly declaring who we are before they even step through the door?
So it's a really interesting question, and has actually, I think, a lot of different components to it, you know, and this individual is sensitive to some of the issues we've just been discussing, right? That as people walk through the doors of a church, we don't know where they're coming from, and they may have either no exposure to church before, or they may have a history, or they may have had some hurts that they're coming with. And I think it's wise in this answer that they couched it that way, right? That we're encouraged to be sensitive to the individual who's coming forward, as opposed to making a lot of assumptions about who has walked through the doors. With regards to the last part of the question about honesty in advertising, I think it's great that they placed that there, because I think the honesty part is really important. I think if we can be aware of who we are as a congregation and actually have why this is of value to us, then that actually can become some of how we explain to people, well, this is why this is why we're here, right? Like your previous example of, well, we care about people. That's why you're here at this community supper, because we care about our community. With regards to code words, I've just been experiencing so many as I've gone to church websites, church plant websites specifically for this current research project, in order to find out like their location, right? So I'm going online to find out where they meet. And the code word thing has come up. I've noticed that in a few. And I think, you know, that's fine if that's how a congregation wants to present, well, here's who we are, right? So they're giving people some way before they come and visit to be prepared for, well, here's some things that are of value to us. I do have a couple of concerns that I would hope congregations have reflected on prayerfully in advance of just taking a sort of marketing keyword kind of approach to what they're doing. And so my two concerns are, and the first one I'm going to frame a little bit negatively, is the word that you've chosen, do you as a church have control over the meaning and the future of what that means? Or does some other group, you know, sort of a social movement or political group or whatever that's currently making use of that word and that's popular out in the general public enough that people would recognize it, do they have control over what the meaning of that word is? One of the issues that I'm hearing discussed right now is the word evangelical. You know, with Canadians being so awash in American political stuff online, what are the significance of that word to someone who's just coming to visit the congregation, right? And those conversations are taking place among churches that are really value the evangelical tradition, right? So I think those kinds of considerations need to be processed as a church, just to be wise. And the other part of it is a code word the best way to enter into conversation with people who might be interested in who you are as a congregation? Or is there another way to frame the same issues, but in a way that encourages discussion and encourages sort of engagement rather than like, here's, you must be this tall to enter this ride kind of experience, right? And so I've noticed, like particularly among church plants, a lot of work around how do we make how people experience this online conversational and engaging, rather than just a more of a blunt statement, I guess. And I think that's where I think the honesty part has to come back in. Like, are we presenting who we are? When you get a little bit more creative that way, like, are you still managing to accurately present who you are as a community of faith? But I have wonderings about that, right? Is that actually more helpful to work at engaging people in a conversation? Or is it more helpful to use a current buzzword as a way to help people be introduced to who you are and what sort of things are important within this congregation?
I think that's well said. Oh, sorry, Matthew, do you want to, I'll leave it to you.
No, I was just going to comment on how I think what you say, you know, in context of the larger picture of someone maybe coming for the first time, it's interesting. It almost heightens the importance of that interaction that they're going to have with a group of people for the first time. So let's say they go on the website or they see something on Facebook or Instagram or something and, oh, here's a code word or something. They're kind of framing who they are in this way. Then they might, you know, look at a sermon online or something, maybe watch a live stream, which more and more people will do before they maybe show up in person. Okay, that's a bit of a flavor. I kind of get where they're going based on those two pieces of information. Then they show up. That's probably really where they're going to get a sense of what it may or may not mean. So just to me, what you said almost heightens the importance of that, you know, that community aspect when people actually show up. Are they having a certain impression confirmed or not? Does it reflect what is represented on the website? It just, I don't know, could you comment on that? Just how those pieces kind of operate together and in the end, the community is going to kind of confirm what is or isn't said in those places.
So I've been talking to people who are attending online for several months before they step foot into the door of the church building and actually experience the in-person aspect of community. So I think this element of how do people experience our understanding as a community of faith? How do they experience us through those online venues? And I've noticed like some of the church plants I've been visiting, they have someone who is obviously like taking pictures, capturing key moments, and they're, you know, updating an Instagram page or putting something on like live streaming onto Facebook. And then there's comments in the sections. So what do people experience of our community through those online opportunities? Are we basically having an internal discussion online and not aware that people are actually visiting online before they visit in person? Or are we actually creating that sort of sense of invitational community through what our presence is online, just like we would hope to do so if someone came to visit us in person? One of the other questions I have that I haven't really found someone to ask yet to get a good impression, there's a couple who presented at an interdenominational webinar we did, who had actually started an online church during COVID. And so they talked about what does it mean to engage people online, like to actually try and develop a relationship rather than just convey information. And I'm wondering how many of our congregations have sorted out what it means to have sort of an almost an online pastoral presence or online greeter who's actually facilitating people having relationship who aren't already part of the congregation. Yeah. And that's one that I think is new ground for a lot of our churches.
I think it is. And when I was actually interviewed for my current position a few months ago, they asked me, what are your ideas for increasing community online? They have a significant 40 or 60 people watching online. And how do we engage them? And I said, I don't know. And this is an interview for a job I wanted, but I really don't know. But I think it's definitely an important thing that we have to discover together.
I wonder if, in light of that, Alton, maybe we should skip to that next question because it's kind of on this subject, and then I'll come back to the one before that at the end.
Yeah. So we'll do that last question, which we've already covered, I think, Matthew. I don't know if we need to ask it, actually.
Okay.
I'm going to edit this out, and you can just end with what's the point of rearranging the chairs.
Okay. Yeah, no, okay, that's good. And I think with the whole thing with the online community is something that we also are kind of struggling with how to figure out. And so we've done something where one of our elders is now oversees in a new area that we've designated as online engagement. Now, we're still figuring out what that means, but there's people online. And, you know, we love for people to come in person if they're able. But, you know, the reality is that some people for mobility issues can't get out of their apartment, or they're sick, or they're working and they're out of town. There are legitimate reasons why people aren't there. But sometimes it's like, we don't know. And I found, Alton, I'd be interested in your comment on this, is that in the pandemic, when everything was shut down and it was just like, there's some tech people, the music director and me at the front, you know, you're looking at camera, you're more aware that everyone is out there. But then when people come in, you know, I'm still aware that things are being live streamed and you get messages occasionally from people and such, but you're like, your attention is more on the people there. I'm seeing the people there. Oh, I'm reminded so-and-so has that test result coming in on Tuesday. Oh, I see so-and-so and I know they're having a tough time with A, B, or C. So visibly seeing people reminds you about them. And so, you know, we've got congregational lists and I try to be diligent and think about who is out there as well. But sometimes you just don't know, right? And so that's kind of a bit of a question mark. How do we engage people? Sometimes we don't even know who or what's going on in their lives.
Well, that's exactly it. During COVID, I was very aware of who was there because I was on my phone during songs, checking out, even interacting with people while maybe a song was going on, a real quick message or something. And the second we were back in person, there were still 40 or 50 people online, but I was not engaging with them, you know, and I think it's so easy to be out of sight, out of mind. I really like that idea of having, what did you call it? An engagement elder?
Elder who oversees online engagement.
Online engagement. That's a great idea. Now the question is, how do you do that effectively? This is a pioneering era, but it's something that's certainly important for us to do.
I do think there may be something about, you know, this idea of invitational community that we've been discussing, that in whatever we're doing, how we're having contact with people, where is the invitation for them to take a step further in faith and a step further into community? And so whether or not it's an in-person event, you know, it's the community supper that you folks are putting on, or it's the church service, the worship service in person, or it's an online discussion that's coming off of the live stream, where are the opportunities that are appropriate, that aren't too pushy, that aren't manipulative at all, but are natural for inviting people, hey, you could also check out this, or you'd also be welcome to come and join us for this. I'm thinking of one of the Salvation Army pastors who I worked with over the years, who said that it was a big realization for him that there's someone coming out to the food bank who considered the Salvation Army their church because they volunteered for an hour at the food bank and realized, well, why aren't we inviting them to the congregational picnic? They consider this their church. You know, this is one of their places of finding relational connection within the community. Why don't we also invite them to come and be part of what other things we do? And so I think that part, we can sometimes assume that people know that they're welcome, but maybe there's ways in which we can intentionally, like, invite people to come and be part of some of the other things that we have going on that that may be of interest and have sort of that relational component and have some element of, you know, what we're encouraging in terms of faith.
That's a great topic. When you have established and set up that workshop, let us know, because we're going to come.
This is the workshop. This is the workshop, Matthew.
Well, there's so many things. Each one of these questions could be an hour conversation in and of itself. But the last question is kind of a big one. It's pretty broad, but I think it's a good point to end on as well, because it is just that. What's the point of rearranging the chairs while the ship is sinking?
So I love this question. You know, I have an image from a popular film coming to mind immediately, as you know, Celine Dion maybe singing in the background. But I was quite intrigued by trying to imagine what the emotional state was of the person asking this question. Right. So if the emotional state of the person asking, what's the point of rearranging the chairs while the ship is sinking, is, you know, of despair, you know, like, this is disappearing, this is dissolving, there's no point, then I think I would need to say to them, yeah, well, I guess you need to think about what the future holds. What is the next thing? What is the legacy that's being offered? What is, you know, and close up shop as best you can, right? And offer care to people who are part of that sinking experience, and think about, well, what can be gifted forward for the future possibly. But if they're asking the question, what's the point of rearranging the chairs, because they're actually looking for some kind of opportunity, I have several stories that come to mind of congregations where there was a definite downward trajectory in terms of number of people who were coming out to worship, number of people who were engaged in volunteering with the congregation, and a very distinct upward trajectory in terms of age of the congregation. And I can think of three distinct situations where there was something, the act of rearranging the chairs actually opened up people to new possibilities. Okay, so the one place, and I recognize this is probably very unique to their experience, the new pastor came in and she said, you know, our sanctuary could really use some freshening up. Why don't we put a new coat of paint on the walls? I think we'll make it look so much brighter in here. And they did that, and congregants came in and said, oh, this does feel nice. This is great. Oh, we can do this. She said, yeah, we can make changes. And that opened up a whole, like, obviously, the person coming in had some enthusiasm, some energy, but it opened up this whole idea of, oh, well, we could, why not? We could try doing this. And like one of the things that ended up out of this experience of trying to rearrange the chairs that ended up being really positive is like, oh, well, we have a huge apartment building beside our building. Why don't we just contact everybody and welcome them to come out to our event? Like, we're going to do a neighborhood community party thing. And they realized with the people who were in that apartment building, it worked best to actually phone them. Like, they weren't email folks, they weren't text folks, they weren't Instagram folks. And so their team would work at calling 200 people and inviting them personally to come to their event, and then to have a big community event that people would be excited about, and the congregation felt some enthusiasm about, oh, well, this is a contribution we're making to the community. And yeah, we're having these great conversations with people. Another example would be a congregation where I went in and did like a congregational life cycle thing with the, at a congregational meeting. And they were very open with me. They said, James, this town has been losing companies at like one a year. And it used to be companies that had 300 employees. Now it's companies with 30 employees that are shutting down and moving to more urban centers. And presented like the idea of the congregational life cycle, like they identified as being in sort of maintenance or crisis zone, and that things were not going well. And then the pastor very boldly, I think, a little while later said, okay, well, we have two choices. We can either go to its natural end and close the congregation and just try and make that a good experience for all. Have people come in who can provide chaplaincy and think strategically about what legacy can be gifted forward. Or we could opt to try some changes and see if we can change the curve. And they all said, yeah, Pastor, we want to change the curve. We don't want like the gravestone as being our on our watch as being what happens. And so I came to them and said, well, like, went around to the individual leaders and said, well, what are you going to change? Oh, like my thing would have to change. I'm not comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. Right. So they decided for the whole congregation changing to happen, but for their own area of ministry or area of responsibility, they weren't comfortable with that. So the pastoral couple there tended to be very persistent people. So they came back and said, well, we like to start new things. Would it be okay if we tried like a young adult cafe kind of thing in town here? And they tried a couple variations on that didn't quite work. And so they came back and they said, well, we think we've seen this model of doing like children's ministry elsewhere. Could we try something like that might work for this community? Because we have a lot to offer in terms of our building and in terms of some ideas about how we can serve children in the community and there, and then have, you know, meaningful contact with some families that we're helping. And it was interesting, like the couple were sort of close to retirement, but they'd been movers and shakers their whole life. You know, they're very engaged folks. They needed to have something to move. And I remember them being very frustrated at the beginning of that 5-year journey when they arrived, that there was this resistance to change. But about year 3 or 4, when I was talking with them, they said, well, now I meet like some of our leadership team in the hall and they say, we're so excited for our next board meeting because we don't know what crazy idea you're going to present next. And they said, by the time they'd reached that third iteration on trying something new, the children's ministry thing, they said they now had people excited and wanting to volunteer from the congregation and be part of that. And so when they reached their retirement point, I actually heard some resignation or sadness in the pastor's voice of saying, you know, I think this could turn around. I think we have some forward momentum and enthusiasm at this point.
Wow.
Right. So I think we can't underestimate how that exercise of shifting the deck chairs might actually shift the balance. And I think there's something about openness to imagination. I've sometimes visited like a congregation of 20 something people who are on that far end of the life cycle. And there's almost like a spiritual depression. Like, you know, we tried this and it didn't work. We can't, you ask them about the future and they can't articulate anything about the future. And then I've been with like groups of 20 that have like no resources, no building, but they're in that early stage of life cycle. And it's like, oh, well, God can do anything. So we don't know what all the crazy things God is going to do. And I realized, the one has resources, the one doesn't, but the one that doesn't is quite super pumped. And the one that does have resources is very down. And it's that matter of if I was to put it into spiritual terms, I think it's that sense of confidence in that, well, God can do amazing things. And maybe a little bit of not being caught up in all the challenges or things that haven't worked, right? The ones that are hugely positive, I think they view things that don't work as learning experiences. And so, oh, okay, well, that didn't work. But this kind of part was kind of valuable and it was kind of helpful to us. And we saw some people connect to this. What if we changed it this way, right? And tried this. But I do recognize there's a certain amount of communal energy, imagination, creativity required to have that. And so I think that's maybe one of the bigger, deeper congregational questions is how do we encourage that sense of, oh yeah, well, God's quite amazing. And we may be surprised. And, you know, if it doesn't work out, then we tried and we've learned something in the process. Right. So I think that part, it's sometimes challenging to nurture, but I think it's hugely, hugely valuable. And it's been funny to me, some of the things that have been the tipping point that seem to allow a congregation to, again, have a positive idea about what the future might hold.
Yeah. Yeah, that's helpful in the communal, you know, enthusiasm or tipping point. And when someone does try something, and I'm sure we can all think about situations in our own churches where they might fit into this category where, you know, oh, here's a new idea. And we tried something and, oh, it actually feels good. And that can kind of influence, well, maybe the next thing will feel good too, and maybe it might actually work. Just be mindful of the time. Dr. Watson, thank you so much for taking this time, not only coming up to Barry a little while ago and speaking to us and being so gracious in that, answering some questions on the spot after your talk, but also taking this time to speak with Alton and I on behalf of our team and the presbytery at whole. Just before we close it down, I wondered if Alton or James, if either of you had kind of a final comment that you wanted to share with our listeners here in the presbytery, but also beyond, just about Invitational Community.
I'll let Alton have the final word, but I just want to say thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this conversation. I've found it really encouraging. It's just a lovely, lovely group of people to be able to spend time with for the evening there and to be part of worship there. Just, I really found that very encouraging and very valuable. So thanks so much for including me.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for coming. Alton, the final word is with you.
Yeah, James, I'm so appreciative that you would come up all the way up to Barrie and spend time with us and to join us for this pod. And thanks to you, Matthew, for having me on. You're really going to take off now after I've been on, I think.
James, sorry, go ahead.
My final thought would be this, is my heart goes out to the person who asked that last question. You can sense the despair in their voice. And having been an interim moderator in many small churches, I felt that despair. I've walked that journey with congregations, and I walked a journey with a congregation that had to close because they simply just didn't have the people. They had money in the bank, but they didn't have the energy to keep going. And it can feel like just the world is falling apart. And I just want to encourage them that as long as you have Christ in your life, as long as you're showing the love of God, as long as you are pouring that love in other people and spending time in worship, you are the body of Christ, and you may not be part of a large institution that the church once was in its heyday, but that doesn't mean that God has abandoned you or this world, and it doesn't mean that you are not still an effective disciple. So just keep making disciples, keep loving on people, keep being authentic and genuine, and sit on that deck chair if you want, but get off it from time to time and see what God is doing in this world, because you'll be amazed. He is still very active.
That's a great word. Thank you, Alton. James, where can people find you, either at the center or if they want to read some articles that you find would be helpful on this subject?
Good question. This is sort of a transition year for me. I have a one-year contract with Wycliffe College as research fellow, but you can find the Canadian Institute for Empirical Church Research on there. And by the fall, we should have some interesting research coming up from the multiple streams of research we're doing on the church in Canada, including revitalization and planting. I also do some teaching at Tyndale University in Toronto. And so jwatson@tyndale.ca also works as a contact point. The Tyndale Intercultural Ministry Center is one of the places that I've done collaborative research with. And so if you look that up online, some of the past research studies that we've done can be found there. And a number of them pertain to the relationship between the church and immigration and how the church plays a supportive role for immigrants integrating into Canadian society.
Awesome. Well, thanks everybody and everyone out there listening. May God bless you.